Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of the theological underpinnings of the second-placed Republican presidential candidate who is rising in the polls, Dr. Ben Carson, whose appearance at a White House prayer breakfast at which he aggressively criticized his host, Barack Obama, made him an instant hero of the religious right and the Tea Party movement. Sarah Posner, a contributing writer at Religion Dispatches, where she has an article on guns and religious liberty, Ben Carson leaves fellow Adventists mystified, joins us to discuss how Carson has allied himself with the Tea Party and the religious right despite his Seventh-day Adventism, not because of it, as well as Carson's conspiratorial belief that secular progressives are the enemy within America and that he would engage America in a battle royale with the Russians in Syria. Then we'll contrast the upcoming first debate of the Democratic presidential candidates with the recent Republican candidates' debates, where both Fox News and CNN moderators seem more interested in creating friction among the candidates than shedding light on their policies and positions on issues. Michael Cohen, a columnist for the Boston Globe and the London Observer and author of Live from the Campaign Trail, The Greatest Presidential Campaign Speeches of the 20th Century and How They Shaped Modern America, joins us to assess whether substance over sound and fury that signifies nothing will prevail in tonight's Democratic debate. Then finally, we'll look into the just-released report from the Dutch Safety Board on the shootdown of the Malaysian airliner over rebel-held Ukraine that makes it clear a Russian-made Buk missile shot the plane down, killing all 298 aboard, but stopped short of saying who fired the missile. A former Swedish diplomat, Anders Aslan, a professor at the Center for Eurasian, Russian, and Eastern European Studies at Georgetown University, joins us to discuss how the many conspiracy theories manufactured by Russian propaganda to muddy the waters have now been put to rest, and whether in the forthcoming criminal report, the Dutch will lay out the overwhelming evidence of Russian culpability and hold Putin responsible for the deaths of 298 innocent civilians. And joining us now is Sarah Posner, who's a contributing writer at Religion Dispatches and the author of Gods, Prophets, Faith, Fraud, and the Republican Crusade for Values. Her work has appeared in The American Prospect, The Nation, Salon, The Washington Spectator, and the religion blogs at The Washington Post and The Guardian. And she has an article at Religion Dispatches on guns and religious liberty, Ben Carson leaves fellow Adventists mystified. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sarah Posner.
Thanks, Ian.
And we're talking about Ben Carson here, who's running second in the Republican presidential primary race at the moment and even gaining on the leader, Donald Trump. So he's somebody that we should be certainly investigating. And I guess it's a little known fact that he is a Seventh-day Adventist. But as you point out in your article in Religion Dispatches, it appears that Ben Carson has allied himself with the Tea Party and the religious right despite his Adventism, not because of it. So elaborate on that, if you will.
Well, for the piece, I talked to a few Seventh-day Adventists and read up on other Seventh-day Adventists' views on Ben Carson's politics, particularly his stated allegiance with the religious right Tea Party idea that we are a Christian nation. And what really prompted this was his statements on guns after the terrible shooting massacre in Oregon the week before last. Carson's views, he says we should, people should arm themselves to defend themselves against attackers like this. And this whole idea of the Christian nation is not drawn from his Adventist beliefs. It's drawn from Tea Party and religious right beliefs. Seventh-day Adventists are proponents of nonviolence. They're conscientious objectors during wartime. And on the religious liberty question, their entire existence in the United States since the mid-19th century has been focused on preserving their own religious liberty in the face of government oppression or societal oppression of their somewhat exotic belief system that compels them to worship on Saturday instead of on Sunday, and some other things. I mean, it's not too terribly exotic, but for a long time, Seventh-day Adventists were considered by a lot of mainstream evangelicals to be out there with Mormonism.
Well, there are approximately 1 million Seventh-day Adventists in the United States and 18 million worldwide.
Right.
But the point that you're making is that they are firm believers in the separation of church and state. They're not dominionists like Ted Cruz and Carson, in effect. They're basically saying that, in fact, didn't they issue a kind of directive within the Adventist church that they don't support political candidates and certainly not Ben Carson?
Right. I mean, they have long avoided getting entangled in questions of politics. They haven't put themselves out there. I mean, obviously, there are individual Adventists who may take positions publicly on these things, but the church as a whole has not taken a political position on abortion or same-sex marriage, those sort of classic culture war wedge issues. And when Ben Carson announced his candidacy for president, the church put out a statement saying, look, you know, we don't want employees of the church talking to the press about Ben Carson or the church's stance on his candidacy or anybody else's candidacy, because we don't get involved in that stuff. And in fact, Seventh-day Adventists have been at the forefront of religious freedom and religious freedom cases under the Free Exercise Clause. A Seventh-day Adventist was the plaintiff in a landmark religious freedom case where she contested, it established the right of a Seventh-day Adventist or anybody else to refuse to work on Saturday, which is their Sabbath.
So where then does he get his beliefs from, even though Ben Carson himself says that, you know, he certainly makes no secret that he's a Seventh-day Adventist, and he said in his best-selling book, Gifted Hands, that the Adventist denomination is the only spiritual home I've ever known. Mm-hmm. I'm an elder at the Spencerville Seventh-day Adventist Church in Silver Springs, Maryland, and I'm also health and temperance director, which means I present special programs and coordinate the other medical workers in our church. So he's involved with the church, but his beliefs have a way out there in a different universe.
Well, you know, this is a case of somebody who apparently is very dedicated to their faith, which, you know, he came to in his childhood. He's been a Seventh-day Adventist since he was a little boy. I mean, he documents that in the book Gifted Hands, but who seems far more influenced by the politics of the American far right. So while he may, you know, possibly adhere to, you know, Seventh-day Adventists are known for their commitment to health and wellness, and obviously by becoming a doctor, he was fulfilling that goal, and he may obviously still in his own personal life be very committed to health and wellness. But on the political front, he seems to have left behind anything he might have learned from Seventh-day Adventists in favor of these far-right conspiracy theories, like what he said about guns and Nazi Germany. I mean, he didn't make that up. That's a terrible anti-Semitic conspiracy theory that lies at the heart of a lot of far-right pro-gun advocates' theories in the United States. Ben Carson is not the first person to articulate that conspiracy. So while it conflicts, obviously, with his faith and the tenets of his faith, he seems to have put more stock in these far-right claims about guns or the Christian nature of the United States of America or other things where he's pretty much towing the line on the Tea Party religious right sort of ideology.
Right, and then we can't have a Muslim president in the United
right,
States.
Right, exactly. Yeah. That's another piece of it because, you know, Seventh-day Adventists, Their eschatology is centered on a possible persecution of them by the United States government for the views of their faith that conflict with mainstream Christianity in the United States, namely the Saturday Sabbath observance. So Seventh-day Adventists have been very attuned to religious freedom issues and the discrimination that minority faiths in the United States face. So it seems particularly ironic then that he would make that statement about Muslims because he comes from a faith tradition that has experienced that kind of discrimination.
Again, I'm speaking with Sarah Posner, who's a contributing writer at Religion Dispatches and the author of God's Prophets, Faith, Fraud, and the Republican Crusade for Values. Her work has appeared in The American Prospect, The Nation, Salon, The Washington Spectator, and the religion blogs at The Washington Post and The Guardian. She has an article at Religion Dispatches on guns and religious liberty. Ben Carson leaves fellow Adventists mystified. So Ben Carson did an interview last Friday with Charlie Rose on his PBS program. And frankly, it's alarming, his views, particularly his views that secular progressives are a threat, pose a threat to the United States, a threat from within, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
You know, which is, it's almost echoes of Nazi Germany and Hitler, the threat from within with the Jews. You got to round them up and kill them. He didn't go that far. But any American politician, whether it is Ben Carson or Michelle Bachmann, who talks about the enemy within, the communist conspiracy within America, these are very dangerous areas to get into. Let's play the clip of Ben Carson talking to Charlie Rose about how secular progressives pose a threat and how this country is under threat of a socialist takeover. In case you didn't realize you were actually living in a right-wing country, this guy believes that the left is about to take over. Just let's hear the clip.
I believe very much in what the founders of this country wanted, which was a country that was of, for, and by the people, with the government being there for the purpose of facilitating life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The socialist model believes something quite contrary to that, that the government knows best, and that somehow there's going to be this utopian society where nobody has to worry about anything from cradle to grave.
And who do you think in American politics is advocating the socialist model?
Barack
Obama?
I think it's very consistent with a lot of the policies of the people who want big government and big government programs. It should be pretty easy to identify.
Okay, but I mean, that's just a classic argument that you know, you're opposed to. And Ronald Reagan made the argument, I'm opposed to big government. I believe government is a problem, not the solution. These are not new ideas, but those weren't conspiratorial ideas either.
It depends on whether you believe it's a conspiracy when a bunch of people want to fundamentally change America.
And who are they? I mean, I genuinely want to understand who it is that you think pose a threat to America.
I think anybody who wants to change our system.
Okay, but I mean, that doesn't help us understand who you're talking about.
I think it's pretty clear. I don't want to understand it.
No, I do want to understand. I really do. But tell me who they may be.
Well, progressives, secular progressives.
Okay, but to identify who represents secular progressives.
I don't know that any one person represents them. There's a whole group of people who are secular progressives. I don't think it's that hard to figure out who they are. And the election next year is going to be a bellwether, because it's going to be an opportunity for America to make a very clear choice. Do you want to go the secular progressive route with big government and big government programs and the government taking care of you from cradle to grave until they run out of money? Or are you interested in a country where the people are at the pinnacle?
And that's a clip from Charlie Rose's program last Friday, where he interviewed Dr. Ben Carson, who's running for president of the United States as a Republican. Sarah Posner, what's your response to, are you a secular progressive by any chance?
Yeah, so what's funny, so Ben Carson's views have long roots in the American conservative movement. What he's saying, Ben, again, with the gun thing, the gun and the Nazi thing, he did not make this up at all. All of this has echoes dating back to conservative Christian fears and conspiracy theories about a fifth column in the United States during the Cold War. It dates back to the early 1960s after religious conservatives were upset that the Supreme Court had struck down mandatory school prayer and Bible reading in two twin cases in 1962 and 1963. And all of that got kind of mixed together, right? So like that was still during the Cold War. They had laid the roots for these conspiracy theories that there was an enemy within in the United States and, a communistic enemy in the United States. You mix in this secularism after the prayer and Bible reading cases in the Supreme Court. And so all of this has very deep roots in American conservatism. And Ben Carson is basically reiterating these ideas without putting much specificity out of them. I mean, Charlie Rose is asking him, well, who are these people who are going to ruin America, essentially? And he finally says, well, the secular progressives. To him, progressive is the equivalent of socialist, and secular, of course, is the worst thing, because the secularists are the people who don't believe in prayer in school and don't believe in entangling religion and politics. But when I listen to Ben Carson, I think we're used to hearing that sort of rhetoric from a fiery Republican like Ted Cruz. It sounds strange coming out of Carson because he has that very sort of soft-spoken, almost catatonic way of speaking, and so it seems weird that he's saying these highly conspiratorial things without all the fire and brimstone. But he's drawing it from the same well as anybody else who's going to make those same sorts of comments, like, you know, Michelle Bachmann or Ted Cruz or Alan West, the former congressman from Florida, who's had said similar things. It's it has a long history.
Well, if that doesn't scare you, the enemy within, the fifth column notion, which is, I think, is incredibly pernicious. Let's play a clip of him talking about foreign policy, about what Putin is up to in Syria. This is a clip from Charlie Rose's interview with Dr. Ben Carson last Friday.
We have to stand up to them completely, not only in Syria, but I think throughout the world. And, you know, I think we should have, you know, armored brigades, you know, throughout the whole Baltic Rim. I think we should reestablish our missile defense system, which caused no end of consternation to Putin. I think we should supply offensive weapons to Ukraine, because they got rid of their nuclear weapons, sort of with the tacit understanding that there would be protection if they were invaded.
Yeah, we were happy about that, for Ukraine to get rid of the nuclear weapons that the Russians had.
Right. Right, exactly. But
and the NATO, the Baltic countries are part of NATO, and we're committed to the NATO agreement to defend them.
And most importantly, we should recognize that the reason that Putin's been kept under control is because of the very low oil prices.
Right.
And he's not been able to get revenue. Now,
and sanctions.
And we also ought to put our little brain into gear and say, you know, that could be the real reason that he's trying to get back into the Middle East. He wants to use this as his base, and he wants to expand his influence, and he wants to be able to gain control of oil there so that he can then control the pricing, which will give him the monies that he needs.
Okay.
So we have to be thinking about all of these kinds of things.
So, for example, let's talk about, should the United States create a no-fly zone? So that his
along
plane,
the Turkish border?
Throughout as much as possible in terms of areas of Syria that we could control.
Sure.
We should.
Absolutely.
And if they invade that no-fly zone?
We would have a conversation with them and let them know that that's a no-fly zone. And we would do that in cooperation with the Turkish. And yes, we would enforce
it. And if they said, we're creating a no-fly zone, we are here at the invitation of the Assad government, and this is a no-fly zone, and if the United States invades this no-fly zone, then we will take action as well.
If they want to create a no-fly zone where we want to create a no-fly zone, then we got a battle royale.
What the message we should send to him today is?
We're not backing down.
And the red line ought to be?
We're not backing down. That's our message to him.
And that is a clip from last Friday's Charlie Rose interview with Dr. Ben Carson. Sarah Posner, this is a pretty scary guy as far as I'm concerned.
Well, you know, he doesn't appear to know much about the political dynamics of anything that he's talking about there. And it's pretty frightening how he seems to not recognize the consequences of the things that he's proposing, which, you know, could be like World War III.
You mean a battle royale.
I mean, it sounds like he doesn't care whether there would be a battle royale
between two nuclear powers, right? Yeah.
Right, and that he wants to be the tough guy in all of this. Again, I think I'm not even sure where some of this stuff he said with regard to some of this foreign policy stuff is coming from. It was incoherent, belligerent and uninformed. And I'm not sure really what to make of it beyond that. I don't know who's advising him on foreign policy, but that was, you know, that was some alarming stuff.
But what's clearly not advising him is his own Seventh-day Adventist religion, because as you pointed out earlier, the Seventh-day Adventists believe in nonviolence.
Mm-hmm.
They have, by and large, been conscientious objectors. They've served in the U.S. military but refused to carry weapons and served in mostly in the medical corps.
Mm-hmm.
This is not a pacifist talking here. This is not a conscientious
objector. No, he does not sound like a pacifist in the least.
Well, so again, he's getting his directions from the religious right, not from the Seventh-day
Adventist. I'm not even sure with this stuff that he was saying with regard to Putin and Syria. That just sounded to me more like generic, America needs to flex its muscles and be the tough guy around the world kind of rhetoric, which is definitely more of a generic stance than coming specifically out of the religious right. I mean, he was not espousing an evangelical sort of eschatology that we may be looking at, some kind of end time scenario in the Middle East, and Putin may be playing a role in that. I mean, you see some of that currently in some corners of the evangelical world where people talk about this sort of thing incessantly. But other than that, I'm not really sure what to make of what he was talking about there, except that it was quite alarming that this man might be president. Although I have to add, I would hasten to add here, Ian, that I think it's highly unlikely that Ben Carson is going to get the Republican nomination.
Well, then what explains his popularity?
Well, you know, he's riding that Trump wave, right? So he's riding that wave of, we just want someone who's an outsider. Ben Carson has long been known to religious conservatives. I think he came to the attention of the general American public in 2013 when he spoke at the National Prayer Breakfast and was lambasting Obama, who was sitting right next to him during his speech. And that sort of catapulted him onto the national political stage. But before that, he was well known to right-wing evangelicals as a kind of fellow political traveler, even though he was a Seventh-day Adventist. I think a lot of evangelicals kind of viewed him more as a generic evangelical, non-denominational Christian because his political views were so aligned with theirs, and he seemed to be, you know, this quote-unquote strong man of faith. And the reason he wasn't invited to the National Prayer Breakfast. I mean, he was invited to speak at the National Prayer Breakfast because he was well known to that community. He had spoken at a National Prayer Breakfast in the 1990s, too. He's one of two people who've spoken twice at it. So I think that he is, one thing, riding the Trump wave, and for another thing, he was well known to a lot of American conservatives for a long time before he ran for president. But I think that ultimately, I think a lot of his political inexperience is probably going to not benefit him in the end in terms of getting the nomination. I think Trump, as far as the outsiders in the field go, Trump stands a much more likely chance of getting the nomination than Carson does. I don't know if that makes you feel better, Ian, but...
Well, Sarah Posner, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Sarah Posner, who's a contributing writer to Religion Dispatches and the author of God's Prophets, Faith, Fraud, and the Republican Crusade for Values. Her work has appeared in the American Prospect, The Nation, Salon, The Washington Spectator, and the religion blogs at The Washington Post and The Guardian. And she has an article at Religion Dispatches on guns and religious liberty, Ben Carson leaves fellow Adventists mystified. We're going to take a brief station break and be back contrasting the upcoming first debate of the Democratic presidential candidates with the recent Republican candidates' debates.
God is a concept by which we measure our pain. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Thank you.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Michael Cohen, who's a columnist for the Boston Globe and the World Politics Review, as well as a political correspondent for the London Observer. He is the author of Live from the Campaign Trail, The Greatest Presidential Campaign Speeches of the 20th Century and How They Shaped Modern America. And previously he served in the United States Department of State as a chief speechwriter for the U.S. representative to the United Nations. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Cohen.
Thanks, Ian. Great to be here.
And in this political season, it's extraordinary the anti-intellectualism that is spewing forth from particularly the leading Republican candidates, Ben Carson, Donald Trump, and Carly Fiorina. And there's no check on it, as far as I can tell. As a matter of fact, all of the more outrageous the statements they make, the higher their poll numbers climb. But where is, in terms of checks and balances, are there in the press? Are facts in any way going to intrude in this presidential season?
I mean, it's a good question. You know, it's funny. I was somebody asked me the other day, what would be the advice that you'd give to Hillary Clinton and for debate? And I said, don't say anything stupid. But I say that, but then on the Republican side, saying things that are ignorant and false and really silly actually seems to be the path toward political success this campaign season. It's one of the strangest phenomena I've seen in quite some time, and I think for some of the press corps, it's kind of hard to figure out how to handle this, because you've got presidential candidates who basically are saying things that are, you know, completely untrue. I mean, Kelly Fiorina on the Planned Parenthood videos is a good example of this. I mean, she simply described the videos in a way that was not correct. She was lying. And the thing is, I disagree a little bit and think that the press corps has really tried to sort of, in some cases, highlight this. It's just hard to keep doing it when candidates are pointed out for lying and continue to do it. It is an interesting phenomenon, and it's one that's hard to sort of deal with, because you can run all the fact checks you want and all of the PolitiFact checks on it and remind people that it's not true, and candidates keep saying it.
Well, it seems in terms of the mainstream press, and first of all, the last Republican debate, which CNN did, Jake Tapper seemed to be under instructions to try and not extract information about these candidates, but actually to pit them against each other. And they had a deal where if anybody insulted you, you were automatically given airtime to rebut the insult. And of course, the insulter-in-chief, Donald Trump, meant that he dominated the stage. On Sunday's interview on 60 Minutes with President Obama, Steve Croft interviewed the President of the United States and kept jumping all over him and not letting him get a word in edgewaves, which is as though to say that's what journalism has become. It's, you know, I'm talking to you because I'm interested in what you have to say. I'm not here to jump on your words, you know?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I thought that CNN debate, you know, was kind of embarrassing, and I hope that they don't do that again for this debate, because it really did sort of lead to just a back and forth and name calling sort of situation in which policy questions were just sort of put to the side. My guess is that debate, since I don't think anyone really wants to attack each other that harshly, you won't see the same kind of dynamic. But, you know, again, I mean, it's hard because you want to be objective and you want to let people say, candidates, you know, sort of say what's on their mind and say what they think. But at the same time, how do you deal with the fact when they say things that are simply untrue or simply incorrect? I think that's a challenge that continues out this election cycle, because you've got Republican candidates who keep saying things that are just made up. So I mean, the thing with Carson, for example, I mean, Carson says things that are just, I mean, so off the wall, so sort of insane. I mean, the idea that you could have prevented the Holocaust by giving people guns, I mean, it's crazy. But I don't know really how you sort of stop it. Just you can point out that it's wrong over and over again, but it's not going to stop people from saying it, not stop candidates from saying it over and over again. And you know, and for what it's worth, this is a new phenomenon that I think has picked up the last few cycles. And you saw it a little bit in 2008 with McCain and Palin. Used to say things that were untrue and be called out for it and continue to say it. Then it escalated in 2012 with Romney, did much of the same thing. And now it's to a point where candidates seem to feel no reluctance to simply lie, and you know, it does. The way it seems to work now is that the electorate is so polarized that if, you know, Republican candidate A says something that's not true and journalists points it out, then sort of the Republican response is, well, this is just the media, you know, jumping all over them, or the liberal media, what have you, and it becomes sort of impossible to correct the facts. And so I think both sides hear what they want to hear. And for Republicans, particularly, they don't, the truth doesn't matter so much. They want to hear what they want to hear from the candidates, and even if it's not true, they're not going to believe the fact check or believe me or someone else saying this is not true.
And again, I'm speaking with Michael Cohen, who's a columnist for the Boston Globe and the World Politics Review, as well as a political correspondent for the London Observer. He's the author of Live from the Campaign Trail, The Greatest Presidential Campaign Speeches of the 20th Century and How They Shaped Modern America. And previously he served in the United States Department of State as the chief speechwriter for the U.S. representative to the United Nations. But is this to say then that anti-intellectualism is on the rise, that there has been a dumbing down in our politics? It does seem to me that ever since John McCain chose Sarah Palin, who was so manifestly unqualified, that has sort of lowered the bar a bit, to say the least. And when you've got people like Ben Carson saying outrageous things, even though he's a brain surgeon, he seems to have little knowledge of anything else. And then you've got, for example, Kevin McCarthy, who was up to be the new speaker, but he pulled out allegedly because the Tea Party caucus had some, going to release some salacious story about an affair he was having with a fellow congresswoman. But if you saw the clips, in fact, Rachel Maddow played them, of Kevin McCarthy's recent remarks to the press, they were completely incoherent. They really made Sarah Palin look like she was breathtakingly articulate. And yet,
well, you know, the funny thing on McCarthy is that actually he was felled by the fact that he told the truth. Right, that was actually what his problem was. He was honest about the purpose of the Benghazi committee. So you know, apparently, the lesson you take away from that is to tell the truth, or if you're a Republican politician, it's not a good idea. I think Palin, this process probably, you know, predates Palin, but certainly she can just, was sort of the first person on the national ticket who was so clearly unqualified. But look who's leading the race. I mean, you've got Trump and Carson getting about half the vote right now in the polls, and neither one of them, seem to have any idea what they're talking about when it comes to any major policy issue. And, you know, and honestly, it's not just them. It goes to even the people who are, you know, allegedly professional politicians. You know, you've got Bobby Jindal running around, you know, blaming the father of this shooter in Oregon for the, and blaming video games and things like that for gun violence. I mean, you've got, people like Jeb Bush talking about, you know, stuff happens in response to gun violence. I mean, Ted Cruz, I mean, he's certainly no paragon of truth and sincerity. So it really is at this point sort of a race to the bottom. And the thing is, if I'm a Republican, you know, candidate looking at who's winning, Trump and Carson right now leading, you know, why would I feel like I need to be, you know, adhering to facts? That doesn't seem to be hurting either one of those two. So I think this is going to continue. And I think, look, it's only October of 2015. We've probably 13 months to go. It's sort of hard to imagine how sort of silly this campaign can get.
Yeah, but it's almost as if you're saying, Michael Cohen, that it's not so much that we need better candidates. It sounds like we need a better electorate. I mean, is this what's going on, that literally America is getting dumber and dumber?
I wouldn't go there, because I think, you know, I think this defines in many ways the modern Republican Party, and I think it defines maybe not the entire Republican electorate, but certainly a healthy segment of the electorate. You know, it's not that necessarily Democratic voters are all sort of incredibly well versed in every single policy issue, but you don't see this kind of, you know, race to the bottom happening on the Democratic side. You just don't. And for what it's worth, you know, the Democrats, at least, wherever you come down, for Sanders or Clinton or whoever, there does seem to be somewhat of a rigorous element of a policy debate going on in the Democratic primary. That's just not happening on the Republican side. I mean, I think in a lot of ways this is a product of a Republican Party that is anti-intellectual, anti-science, anti-facts, and is defined by resentment and fear, and will basically give their allegiance to which presidential candidate most speaks to their resentments and fears. I mean, I think that's really what it comes down to. And I think, you know, I hate to put all the burden on one side, but I do think that there's, you simply can't deny the fact that the Republican Party, this is sort of where it's moved you in the past couple of years. It's toward this extraordinary anti-intellectual mindset. But I can't say that I think that speaks for the entire electorate.
Well, the neuroscientist at Berkeley, George Lakoff, who has done some interesting work on how semantics play a huge role in politics and how you frame arguments, and he's always argued that the Republicans are much better at framing things, for example, like tax relief. So how could you be against tax relief? You must be therefore in favor of tax pain. And his argument is in many ways that the Democrats are victims of the Age of Enlightenment. They think that because you come up with the best argument and you have the most intelligent and cogent points that you make in a debate, you therefore win. There's such a thing as emotional intelligence. So do you think that that is an aspect? I'm not making excuses for the anti-intellectualism, but the fact that it seems to attract such passionate adherents on the Republican side is both fascinating and scary.
I mean, it is, but it's not a new development. I mean, we've seen this Republican side for maybe for a couple of years now. But again, I think it's a product of the Republican Party becoming more and more radical and more extreme. And I think the electorate getting more polarized when that happens. I think people sort of, you know, sort of moving into their own camps, to their Democratic-Republican camp, and basically only believing the people that they listen to and sort of closing their minds off to new viewpoints.
Well, just in the last minute then, how would you rate the Democrats' chances in 2016? It seems like it would be a cakewalk with Trump versus Clinton and even Trump versus Sanders.
At this point, you know, it's hard to say. I mean, the way I look at it this way is the Democrats have won. I think it's five of the last six presidential elections, they won the popular vote. The electorate, you know, in major, it's a Democratic-leaning electorate, presidential elections. And considering how radical the Republican Party has become, my inclination is to think the Democrats have a major advantage. But, you know, it's 13 months away, so who can say with any kind of certainty. But if I were Democrat, I'd be feeling a lot better than if I were Republican.
Well, thank you very much for joining us here today, Michael Cohen.
Thanks so much, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Michael Cohen, who's a columnist for the Boston Globe and the World Politics Review, as well as a political correspondent for the London Observer. He's the author of Live from the Campaign Trail, The Greatest Presidential Campaign Speeches of the 20th Century and How They Shaped Modern America. And previously he served in the United States Department of State as chief speechwriter for the U.S. representative to the United Nations. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into the just-released report from the Dutch Safety Board on the shootdown of the Malaysian airliner over rebel-held Ukraine. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Anders Aslund, a professor at the Center for Eurasian, Russian, and Eastern European Studies at Georgetown University, and a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council. He worked as a Swedish diplomat in Kuwait, Poland, Geneva, and Moscow, and served as an economic advisor to the governments of Russia, Kyrgyzstan, and Ukraine. And his books include How Ukraine Became a Market Economy and a Democracy, and his latest book is Ukraine, What Went Wrong and How to Fix It. Welcome to Background Briefing, Anders Aslund.
Thank you very much.
And the Dutch Safety Board have come out with their report on the shootdown of MH17, the Malaysian airliner that was shot down over eastern Ukraine, killing all 298 people aboard. The report, of course, is a safety report. It's not a criminal investigation, so it doesn't say who fired the missile, but it makes it very clear that it was the plane was shot down by a Buk missile. So what's your sense then of how it's being received? Obviously, Russia is critical, and the rest of the world is pretty much had, I think, come to that conclusion earlier that this is what happened. Do we have to wait for the criminal inquiry, which will be, about a year away?
Well, it should be early next year, and then we will get a clear suggestion, we hope, who actually did it. As you said, this report essentially tells us who have followed it closely exactly what we know, and this has been known mainly through Bellingcat, the organization in London that has followed social media, and the information they provided has turned out to be absolutely correct. So the big point here is, yes, we knew and we could know if we wanted to know, and all of these conspiracy theories that in particular Russian official media have put out have turned out to be wrong. So we know now that it was a Buk missile that was shot somewhere in eastern Ukraine. This report does not specify where it was. And it exploded 1 meter away from the cockpit and killed the pilots instantly. And we don't know if the rest of the passengers died instantly or within the next 90 seconds. Probably they died all instantly. So the technique of it is absolutely clear. So all this Russian official nonsense that there was a Ukrainian plane out there and that it shot it down, it's all wrong. So this is the cleansing. This is an intellectual cleansing process, you can say, while it does not lead us to the actual culprit.
But the head of the report, or the person in charge of the Dutch Safety Board, Mr. Joustra, said in a press conference after releasing the report, said that pro-Russian rebels were in charge of the area from where the missile that hit the MH17 had been fired. So at least he has said where the missile came from.
Yeah, but they offered a rather large area, so the Russians can say that we were not fully in charge of the whole area. So that leaves it more open than they needed to.
Well, clearly for the families, the surviving families, this has got to be pretty hard, isn't it? Most families were concerned about how their loved ones died, and the fact that the pilots were killed instantly because the warhead exploded a meter away from the cockpit, slightly above it on the left-hand side. There's still some speculation that it may have taken up to a minute and a half for the rest of the people to die. That's really, I think, at the heart of it, isn't it? This is just a horrible, horrible humanitarian tragedy that was clearly man-made, clearly unnecessary, and nobody has been charged and taken responsibility for it. And it's one of the most gruesome things you could imagine. And we all fly in aeroplanes, and we all expect an assumption of safety once we're aloft. To my mind, this is a much bigger deal than has, in effect, been made out to be. Do you think that the outrage has dissipated? And is this report going to focus people back on the idea that this kind of thing is completely unacceptable?
Yeah, I think that this is, so to say, the second point. The big point is, of course, who did it. But the second point is what you just said. And I read, to my great surprise, in this report that there were about 160 planes crossing this area of eastern Ukraine the day this airplane was shot down. And this means that virtually all of the big international airlines have such low safety standards. Here, a war is going on. And in the course of the last month, more than a dozen planes had been shot down. Two of them within 3 days from this Malaysian airplane being shot down. And you would expect that somebody would stand up and say, no, we don't. This should not be allowed. And the report goes into this with considerable detail. First of all, it blames the Ukrainian authorities for not having prohibited. And it argues that the Ukrainian authorities saw this primarily from a military point of view. They prohibited flights, if I get it right, up to 32,000 feet, but this plane flew at 33,000 feet. And if such a large area is dangerous, why should you fly over it at all? And so many airplanes, 160 airplanes in one day, and virtually all of them are major airplanes with about 300 passengers, as this one, flying to East or Southeast Asia.
So to the extent to which the Ukrainian authorities then are being blamed for not closing the airspace, does that take the focus off Russia?
Not. That's why I emphasize that it's the second point. And also the report says the other parties involved did not identify potential risk posed by the armed conflict in the eastern part of Ukraine to civil aviation. You have a Malaysian Airlines, you have the International Civil Aviation Organization, you have the co-chairs, including KLM, of this very flight, and you had essentially all the international airlines were flying over this area. So this comes up as a big side point that air security is not sufficient. But most of all, everything points to this being Russian action. And what has come out from these social network activist studies, it is that this was done by professional Russian soldiers, because the equipment, the book that shot down the plane requires 4 years of technical training. So this is not done to any odd rebel or volunteer in eastern Ukraine. What these studies, Bellingcat studies and the interpreter have pointed out, that is that these were one specific Kursk regiment that carried it out. These were professional Russian soldiers under Russian command. And the question is really, how far will the Dutch go in these specifications? We can say now, having received this affirmative report, that we do know what has happened. The question is really, how much will the Dutch authorities dare to say, given that we have said so little in this report?
And again, I'm speaking with Anders Aslan, who's a professor at the Center for Eurasian, Russian and East European Studies at Georgetown University and a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council. He worked as a Swedish diplomat in Kuwait, Poland, Geneva and Moscow and serves as an economic advisor to the governments of Russia, Kyrgyzstan and Ukraine. And his books include How Ukraine Became a Market Economy and a Democracy. And his latest book is Ukraine, What Went Wrong and How to Fix It. But the Dutch prosecutor, Fred Westerbeck, said that a number of persons of interest had been identified in this ongoing inquiry that will be finished, I think you said, early next year?
Yeah.
And they also apparently have already published photos of the launcher being transported around rebel areas. Those photographs and the film of the book Missile were captured by some journalists from AP and other news outlets that were in the area. The book Missile, that was probably the one that was used on its half track, the launcher, was going through a small village. The Western reporters saw it. The Russian officer in charge of this small convoy around the missile went over and talked to the reporters. So it's not as if people, there hasn't been a lot of evidence already. And from the audio intercepts, from my understanding, is that the crew of the Buk missile, along with this officer, the crew were actually from the Sakhalin Islands in the Pacific, west of Russia. So it's about as Russian as you can get. Do you expect all of this information that's apparently out there will be fairly strongly detailed in this upcoming report?
Well, this is the big question, whether the Dutch have the political spine so that they can deliver the information that is available. And indeed, all the information is out. Perhaps the most interesting part of this Dutch report is that it turns out that what we thought was true has turned out to be true. What this report really sorts out is that all these odd ideas that it could be something else have turned out to be wrong. And from what I heard on the radio today, it was that many of the Dutch relatives of the people who had died, that they were relieved to see that they knew at least what had happened. But the big question is what you just formulated. Will the Dutch come out with the very damning evidence that in all probability is there about a direct Russian involvement in this shooting down? I've been to several of these sessions with journalists involved, and what sounds most plausible to me as an amateur in this area is that when you operate one of these Buk missiles, you have to turn on the radar, but you can only have it on for 30 seconds because later on you become a possible target if it is a military plane that you are sighting. So here one officer sits and has 30 seconds to decide, do I shoot or do I not shoot? So there is a very important element of human mistake. And what we heard from these interceptions of Russian officers on the ground at the time was that they thought that they had shot down Ukrainian military plane. That seems rather incompetent, but if you only have 30 seconds, then you may do rather incompetent things. That's my guess, but it's really just an amateur guess.
Well, already Russian state media is predictably saying that this is all a part of a kind of Western plot, and that the Russians are innocent and that the Ukrainians are guilty. And back in July, Russia vetoed a draft resolution at the UN Security Council that prevented an international tribunal into the MH17 shootdown being conducted by the United Nations. They used their veto power. So that was pretty brazen. It would seem to most people pretty hard to believe that anybody except Putin and the Russians understand exactly what happened. How long do you think they can hold out this way? I know that a lot of people here that write me letters complain whenever I'm critical of Putin. They admit that they watch RT. It's pretty hard to believe that people are that gullible that they don't understand that RT is a propaganda operation, an English language adjunct to state media. And, you know, the Russians and during the Soviet times, they developed a tremendous amount of skills at propaganda. And it continues to this day. So that notwithstanding a certain amount of gullibility in the West, do you think that at the end of the day, there will be at least in 90% or 99% of the world an understanding of what happened?
Well, that's a big question, and this is very much up to the Dutch authorities, how they act next time. And the Dutch tend to be very thorough, and they have dug deeply into this. And of course, it was almost 200 Dutch citizens, innocent Dutch citizens, who were killed in this. So it appears to me that it would be very difficult for any Dutch authorities not to take it very seriously. And as you stated, from the Russian responses, we can see that they are just presenting as many different versions as possible, trying to confuse us, saying that anything is possible. rather than insisting that one specific version is the true one. And that suggests that they do know who is guilty. And their problem is, their intention is just to confuse us rather than to present a viable alternative interpretation. So the question is whether they will manage to confuse and diffuse everything, or if there will be one clear message. In that way, I think that this Dutch report was very useful, because it throws away all these conspiracy theories. Now it's only a question who shot the book, not if it was a book that was shot. And in all probability, it came from the eastern Ukrainian occupied territory by the pro-Russian rebels. And this kind of equipment can hardly be managed by the rebels. It's in all probability Russian staff officers who managed it, and perhaps there was one rebel in the command line from the top Russian commanders, but that will make it very difficult for the Russian authorities to blame it on the rebels. So this is truly explosive.
Well, just in closing, though, Vladimir Putin certainly got an understanding that the rest of the world, at least the G20 leaders, they believe that he was responsible. At the G20 meeting last year in Brisbane, Australia, he was ostracized. Nobody would sit down at the table with lunch with him. He had to eat alone at the table, and he was so much sort of frozen out of the club of the leading nations of the world that he left the G20 meeting early in a huff. So at least the world leaders seem to know what really happened, and they seem to have let Putin know that they know. Is that your understanding?
Yeah, it is. And therefore, this looks very interesting. What will happen next? And my assumption is that President Putin is now trying to confuse us all with Syria, partly because eastern Ukraine has become such a mess. And, of course, the shooting down of this Malaysian airplane is a major part of it.
Well, Anders Asselin, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, as always. And pleasure again, to talk to you.
Likewise. And, again, I've been speaking with Anders Asselin, who's a professor at the Center for Eurasian, Russian and Eastern European Studies at Georgetown University and a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council. He worked as a Swedish diplomat in Kuwait, Poland, Geneva and Moscow, and served as an economic advisor to the governments of Russia, Kyrgyzstan and Ukraine. And his books include How Ukraine Became a Market Economy and Democracy. And his latest book is Ukraine, What Went Wrong and How to Fix It. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.